मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Welcome to Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, your weekly source for news, opinion, politics, cricket, and a lot more, all great bong style. I am Vikram Mohan, and we are recording episode 84 on the 10th of May 2020 India time. And also on this week, on the latest episode of Binge On, the theme this time is Telugu comedy movies. And on WhatsApp Geeks, of course, we bring you up to speed with news from the world of tech, and we take a trip down memory lane. In one of my favorite segments. So do check out Binge On and WhatsApp Geeks. And now your host Arnab Ray. Hey Arnab.
Hello. Hello everyone.
So what's on for this week?
So before what's on for this week, let's talk about what's off for this week. I saw Mrs. Serial Killer on Netflix.
And, oh man.
And the first question that somebody would ask me is, why did I see Mrs. Serial Killer on Netflix? Well, first of all, I knew pretty well, going in that it was terrible because people had been asking me to review it, which usually is a sure shot sign that it's terrible. But it also happens to be that, you know, I like serial killer movies, and it's a genre that I like normally. If it was, I haven't seen Shirish Kunder's Joker because besides the egregious copyright infringement in the title itself. That was, again, not a genre of movies that I was particularly fond of, but serial killer movies I like. And of course, I went in totally knowing that it was going to be terrible. But all my expectations of how terrible it was going to be was surpassed. It was way more terrible than I could have imagined it to be.
And is it so bad? It's watchable type or...
No, it's just really bad. It's just really bad. And what Suresh Kunder was trying to do, you know, I hesitate to use the word. It shined through. It basically farted through, I would say, was his intent to make this into a horror comedy, a kind of self-spoofing of itself. And that part of it comes very end, to the very end. If he had consistently stayed with it, then maybe at least you could applaud him for the effort. He was trying to do something like Scream. But of course, Scream is an extremely clever bit of filmmaking, and whatever different sins that Suresh Kunder may have, cleverness is not one of them. So this is obviously something which is beyond his capabilities, and at the very end he tries to do something, but it's just so supremely bad. It is so terrible. And again, the blame for this is not with, at least to me, doesn't lie with Suresh Kunder. Suresh Kunder is really the cinematic equivalent of Robert Vadra, who's allowed to make movies just because he is somebody's husband. And so the real shocking thing is the fact that Netflix quality control and the fact that Netflix allows somebody to put something like this on their streaming platform.
Because
first of all, there is this, I mean, that's the serial killer part of it, that it kills another serial. That is the tragedy. I mean, of course, Jacqueline Fernandez is a terrible actor. And I think I'm coming around to the view that that Modi economics hasn't worked at all and the country is in deep recession. Otherwise, why would Manoj Vajpayee be in that movie? I mean, what kind of economic ruin could have prompted him to sign on the dotted line for any movie which is helmed by Suresh Kunder is beyond me. It is sad to see him there. It's, as I had written, it was like seeing VVS Lakshman, you know, trying to slog in IPL. These are things which just shouldn't happen. You shouldn't have. And he, of course, it's so bad that that Manoj Vajpayee cannot elevate. He's part of the whole. He's terrible in it too. Actually, it's not that he salvages the movie at all. He's terrible too. And again, the biggest villain here is not on screen or behind the camera. It's the people who greenlit this and put it on Netflix, because there's obviously some deserving alternative that didn't make it there. And I don't know what that alternative was, but whatever it was, even if it was a camera stuck on a blank white wall, it would have been better cinema than what we saw.
Yikes, that bad.
Yes. So it wasn't, so anything would have been better than this. And that opportunity cost is the real tragedy here. And the fact that, you know, somebody with so little talent, and that has been amply demonstrated over the years. So this is not like a, you know, good director making something bad. You know, then that happens. Sometimes there are creative misfires. And, you know, sometimes they just, you know, Sachin Tendulkar makes a 0-2. Forget Sachin Tendulkar. I mean, let's say, the Devan Gandhi makes zeros, but in the fault is the selectors for allowing him opportunity after opportunity, and this is the tragedy. And so Netflix isn't like some government. I mean, it's not government; it's a private company, and Netflix has to understand this. That, you know, boss, you know, 2 years ago Netflix had was the only guy in streaming, and that's because they got the technology of it first. So that gave them a first mover's advantage. They used the money that they got from the technology to leverage themselves to get into film production, and now they produce content. But now other studios have realized they've caught on with the technology. The technology is no longer innovative, it's now commodity. Anybody can start a streaming platform. And so the battle is going to be won essentially by somebody who curates content. That is where, you know, even Netflix has lost a lot of its titles. Amazon Prime has taken something. You know, Disney Plus has taken all their. They have a lot of clout now. HBO has started their own HBO something just a few weeks ago. So everybody, CBS Plus is there. They've done pretty well with the Star Trek reboot. So this, everybody has cottoned on to. And then there are, you know, niche things like Shudder for horror, and then Mubi. So there are a lot of streaming platforms. The technology is now commodity, and in order for Netflix to distinguish itself, it has to work on its curation. Yeah, this has a lot of content on it, but the content needs to be curated. And this is not the first time they have done it. This is the second terrible Jacqueline Fernandez movie that they have there, which is an absolute wastage of bits and bytes and processing power in the world. I was shocked to see something this irretrievably bad. Normally when you sit through a movie, you can say, well, okay, but at least that part of it was good. And some people said that the background music was good. Background music was a mishmash straight off from Roshni Se, from Ashoka, and the theme of Suspiria. So there was virtually nothing there which can redeem. And I enjoyed it. I wasn't drunk. I wish I was. Because that way, perhaps I would have enjoyed it more, and perhaps even liked it a little bit. But since I was fully sober while watching it, I could only marvel at the opportunity cost of this, and what other thing we couldn't see because of this bunch of crap that's there. Okay. So what I wanted to discuss today was something that I had written a post on, and it was not a topic that I had not discussed before here, but I wanted to do it again because there are lots of new listeners coming in. And so one was on the topic of layoffs. So right now we are in a state with now that, you know, we are on, I wouldn't say we're on the trailing edge of COVID-19, but I think the world has decided pretty much now that it's, if we don't open it now, then that's it. That's the end. So I can kind of understand some of Elon Musk's frustrations, but honestly speaking, it's a choice. Elon Musk's, by the way, for those of you know, the context is Elon Musk has threatened to move his manufacturing and his, you know, headquarters from California because they're basically not, you know, they're not opening it. And he said, I'll move to Nevada and Texas, which essentially are Republican states with, you know, really no control. So it's ultimately a decision that communities will have to make, whether they value human life more or they value money more, and ultimately it's a risk decision. Of course, it doesn't mean that everybody is going to die, but a lot of people are going to die. Is it worth the lives of your grandparents to have a Tesla manufacturing plant in your community? And given that, and people have said that Tesla has, you know, this guy has done nothing for the community at all. Elon Musk has done absolutely zero for the communities that he has been in. So how does it, you know, if, you know, him saying that I'm going to move my company out of California, which has pretty much all the main companies in the world. This is like, you know, people on Twitter saying, I'm going to unfollow you and stuff. You know, honestly, it doesn't matter. We love you to have, we love the fact that you follow us. But if you try to use that as a leveraging tool to change my opinion or to make me do something, that's just not going to work. So this is similar for California. Sure, they contribute some quite a significant amount in terms of tax revenue, but ultimately California really doesn't care. And also based in the region he is, his factory isn't in Central California or other places which are a little backward. He's in Bay Area where, you know, they'd be very, very easily replaced by, where it's not going to lie there vacant. So, but again, I also see his point as somebody who runs a manufacturing plant. You know, he has to make sure that his cars are being made. He has to look after his bottom line. He has to look after his shareholders, though he does a piss poor job of that also. But moving on, I mean, rather than discussing very rich people, I wanted to talk about us and the impact that about 2 months of closure has had in terms of the massive amount of job losses. The unemployment numbers in the US are, I mean, nobody could have imagined something like this. Almost like 20% of the country is unemployed here. And given that we live in a global economy, it's not just a US problem. It's the ripple effect of this will, like a shockwave from an earthquake will flatten out, you know, places in like India, which are not just India, but places which are dependent on the US economy, which is pretty much the whole world. So you had Uber having, you know, huge number of layoffs. You had Airbnb having, these are companies which 3 months ago were considered to be like this, you know, some very stable companies to work in with very well developed business model. This wasn't some crazy startup, you know, making robot pizzas. Which, by the way, there was a company called That Zoom, and it went belly up too. And it was a SoftBank funded company. But the point again is that layoffs are, you know, are here. And in 2008, layoffs were kind of concentrated in the financial industry. But now layoffs are pretty much pervasive everywhere, whether it be in the IT or whether it be in the service industry. So it's, and the numbers now of layoffs dwarf the number of layoffs there was in 2008 and 2009. I still feel, again, putting on my, you know, not an economist, but I honestly believe that the economy will bounce back much quicker once things open up, because there's fundamentally nothing wrong with the economy, unlike in 2008 and 2009, when there actually was. So I think that this is all temporary. I think once a vaccine is discovered, or once we have some level of control, it's not that the demand for Airbnb or the demand for Uber will go away, that people will just stop traveling, or people, I mean, it'll perhaps go down for a while, perhaps discretionary travel or holiday travel might go down. But I also don't think that to be the case. I read today online that for cruise ships, the demand now that cruise ships are opening is through the roof. Through the roof. They haven't seen this level of demand for cruise. And you would think, why would people be rushing
exactly
to cruise?
Why on earth? Even in normal exactly times, it's not a good idea.
Yeah. So cruise ships are like, it's like disease central. But now, like, they have enormous demand. So that's what I'm trying to say, that sure, the cruise ship business this month, and they wiped out because there were all these ships lying around with absolutely no passengers. But there's going to be an immense rebound, and everything is going to come back. You know, people who haven't cut their hair for all these months, they're going to go and cut their hair, man. So there's going to be demand. This is not going to go away. People are not going to stop, you know, going to the, you know, not getting their hair cut or not traveling. So these things, but that doesn't take away the fact that people have lost their jobs. And there are two things about losing a job. And, you know, I personally have have been laid off. So, you know, there's the first thing that you need to understand in any layoff in today's world is that we grew up watching our parents and the relationship that they had with their jobs was one of permanence. I mean, it was like a relationship. You joined a job and you left after 30 to 40 years. The only reason why you left a job, or why you could leave a job for a few reasons, but the reason why you would get terminated was essentially because you were either monumentally incompetent or you were a crook. That is no. So there was an immense amount of stigma attached to losing your job, of being fired or being laid off. In this day and age, it is absolutely illogical to take a layoff as any reflection of your own skills. And I don't think that, and I'll come back to whether employers consider this to be a negative. In times when entire divisions, entire products are like one day they come in and lose their jobs, it's obvious that it's not because you were incompetent or you did something. This is 100 people, 200 people, 10% of your workforce lose their jobs on one day. It's obviously not dictated by, it's not dictated by competence or by record. It's just, sometimes it's an arbitrary decision. Sometimes it's a commercial decision based on who's doing work that, you know, certain people who you can basically argue should be the first people to get fired, but they don't because they have the decision to fire. So whatever, the world is not a fair place, But the ultimate thing is that it is not your fault. And again, it is not even the fault of the person who's handing you a letter or the person who took your decision. This is essentially capitalism. There is no other option. And it's difficult. It's very difficult to cope. I wouldn't say that even if, you know, how many times you tell yourself that, you know, a layoff doesn't mean anything. It does. It is a deep psychological blow to the extent that the reason why we work, I mean, of course we work for money, but even if you have, let's say, enough savings to last you a year or 2 years of no employment, let's say you've done fairly well, or you have a spouse who's working. So you don't, you know, it's not that if you lose your job, mere bacche kahan soenge, you're not in that state, but it still feels like it. Because precisely because we are conditioned to work, unless you're born, you know, a Rahul Gandhi or an Akash Ambani, that's how you were brought up. You were brought up to find a kind of validation in waking up and going to work and coming home. That is part of the value that you believe you bring to the universe. And when somebody comes and says that, look, we no longer need you, it is a blow to that. It's a blow to your own self-esteem. That's the problem. That's the biggest problem. It's often not financial. Most people in IT, it's not that if they lose their job, they're going to be on the streets immediately. And most people usually get employment also within a few months. So it's not that, you know, realistically, of course, it seems like, oh my goodness, where am I going to go? But if you just think of it dispassionately, that's, I mean, of course, you might take a role with reduced responsibilities. You might have to take a role with lesser salary, that could happen, but that you will not get anything is also highly unlikely. But the stress, the psychological blow comes from something which is deeper, which is our own understanding of our self-worth based on the fact that we have employment, that somebody thinks that what we do has a certain amount of impact. And that is, there's no word of otherwise from that. I mean, that's going to be there. But the thing is that there is no shame. There's absolutely no shame in being laid off. So do you tell your next employer that you have been laid off is the question. And my answer is yes, you should. You should for a few reasons. One is that in this day and age, it is very easy to find out whether you've been laid off. Information is with LinkedIn and with everybody knows who you know, where you worked, everybody has common contacts. It's monstrously easy to find out. So from a purely pragmatic perspective, you can't hide it. Second is you shouldn't hide it. If you lose a job purely because you were laid off, then you should not be joining that job. You should not be working for that hiring manager. That's one way of winnowing out the wrong place to join, is if being laid off is considered a red flag in this day and age, which shows a shocking lack of maturity on part of your hiring organization. You wouldn't want to work for that company. And third is, rather than hearing other kinds of non-answers, if I'm a hiring manager and I see a guy who has worked at a place for 8 months and is interviewing and he says, oh, I was not challenged in the previous job. But first of all, this sets off the red flag. And second is, if it doesn't set off the red flag, somebody thinks, well, not challenged well enough, how long will it take for this guy if I hire him that he will not find it challenging enough? I mean, I am going to give him the work that he's supposed to do. I cannot, as his hiring manager, then think of, oh, I can't give him this work because then he will find it boring. And of course not. I mean, if you're working, that's why you're getting paid, right? So if you're getting paid and you expect your work to be incessantly exciting, then maybe you're not a mature employee, that you're not ready to, hold an office job. That to me is a bigger red flag than saying that I got laid off, which is a perfectly valid reason why you are moving from a company. And as a matter of fact, that's the end of story. Okay, that's fine. So that's, I think that's a lot of stress based on that. And there isn't. And I find that in the US, for instance, today I saw on LinkedIn that Airbnb, one of my readers that he works in Airbnb, he's also one of my LinkedIn connects. He had shared this entire list of people who had lost their jobs from Airbnb, and they were being helped by Airbnb to get their next job. So they were on their website saying, hey, here's a talent profile of all people that we have let go. So the companies themselves saying, we've let these guys go. They themselves obviously have given permission to do that. So this is the level at which, and of course, by the fact that the company is actually putting them on the website, the message is absolutely clear. It's nothing to do with these people. We just do not have the money to hire these people any longer. But we are saying that these people are very good people. So I think this is the level of maturity, and these are forward-looking organizations. And this is the level of maturity that we want in companies. It's fine to let go of employees. I mean, that's capitalism. But then, do you support your employee through the next process? And this is a very, very encouraging and progressive sign that they're doing this. And I hope that this will catch on, and that within 5 years, most companies will be doing this. In such cases where there are mass layoffs, when essentially offices or functions are shifted offshore, that's one of the biggest reasons why people get fired and their roles are eliminated. Or sometimes when just products fail. When products fail, they said, we are not going to be doing this kind of business anymore. This kind of business isn't worth pursuing. So let's just get rid of everybody who's in that business.
So that's the thing. If I could, in fact, just a personal story on my end about what you just spoke about. So I was in Satyam when the ship sank, right? And like you said, in fact, I'm not sure if it was organization sponsored, but various teams, we set up our own kind of, for lack of a better word, placement cells. And so I would, for example, make calls and say, I have these three people in my team, and my boss would call up people and say, okay, talking about me. It was happening, but I'm not sure whether it was a mandate from the organization. But the flip side, Arnab, was at that time, this was again, if you remember, the whole company was in a big question mark. We were not sure what the future is going to hold for us. But there were, and it's going to sound like a Manmohan Desai movie, but there are times when several people used to look at interview and let's say they go to one of the big name IIT companies. They literally used to have a board saying Satyam employees do not apply. So, that I think which one had that dogs and Indians not allowed. So you had something like that over there. So I don't know.
I think that in general, I find that some of the HR practices, to put it bluntly, in Indian companies are regressive and wouldn't pass HR HR best practices globally. I remember the first job that I joined where for India, they asked me my weight and my religion.
Wow. And
yes. They asked me my weight, my religion.
Weight was for the health checkup?
No, no, there was no health checkup. They just wanted to know my weight. There was no reason why. I mean, and they wanted to know my, you know, my religion, which honestly is nobody's fucking business. So, again, those things are just, I hope things have changed, but in an international, you know, global economy, they will change. So coming back to this whole getting laid off. So how do you prevent yourself? So this is the psychological fact. How do you prevent yourself from getting laid off? You can't. Second is that you should always tell yourself every day that your permanent job isn't permanent. It is a contractual job. No matter how they present it, it is, in this day and age, nothing is permanent. So you're, as I'd written a piece on this, so the analogy I used was that you're an Uber driver anyways, except that you, when in a permanent job, you don't know when your destination will arrive. That's all. But it's going to arrive at some point of time. Whether you get off before that or whether you keep driving, that's again up to you. But it is going to happen at some point of the tough time or the other. And so you should never be emotionally invested in that this is it. This is where I will die. No. So in general, whenever you keep your skills always updated, one of the stresses of being laid off is you automatically start thinking, oh my goodness, I have to go and interview now. People will ask me questions about things which I haven't read in the last 20 years. Don't let that happen. Don't let that happen. Always be updated. Always keep yourself updated, not just with skills, but with the skills needed to ace interviews in whatever domain you're in. Always think about yourself that, okay, every month I will spend about 4 or 5 hours making sure that if I lost my job, I will be able, I will have, if you're in programming, then, you know, be up to date with data structures and the kind of questions like, you know, how do you invert a linked list with, the standard questions. So don't wait till you get laid off to start looking at them and start revising. Because that's when the stress comes. Because then you think, oh my goodness, the clock is ticking. I need to get a job within 2 months. I've forgotten everything. So always be prepared. Even if you're not looking for a job, always stay open to contact from recruiters. Talk to recruiters. Always know what your market value is. Always have an estimation of whether what you're doing has any kind of demand. If you find that if you keep your opportunities open part in LinkedIn and no recruiter is reaching out to you, that should be a matter of concern. You should always remember that. And having a Rolodex of recruiter names is a very good thing. If you lose your job, that those are the first guys you're going to reach out to. So it's very important for you to be in the market, both in terms of mentally as well as in terms of your own skills development. Also, when you go to work, and I see this in many places, people make the cubicle as an extension of their living room. Don't do it. Keep your cubicle clean. Okay. Don't put anything there that you cannot take out in one box. Once you lose your job, the last thing you want to do is spend hours cleaning out your cubicle. So always, try not to have anything. Have a picture if you want. But, you know, don't have too many personal belongings in your office, because that is, you know, it seems a minor thing, but on that day in which you get your letter, it's the last thing you want to handle is your own belongings in that place. You want to leave that place as soon as you can. And again, the last thing that I would always want to say is that, you know, sometimes the inertia of motion of getting up every day and going to work, it prevents us from asking our question is, are we happy in the job that we are doing? Ultimately, I mean, I sound like a life coach, but ultimately the only currency is happiness. Money is a way of attaining happiness, but there are other ways of being happy too. So are you happy in the job that you're doing? Nobody's saying that you're deliriously happy in the job that you're doing. With maturity, I never believe in that, in the maxim that comes from a myriad TED Talks, is that if you love what you do, then you don't work a day in your life. Of course you don't love what you do. That's why they pay you. God damn it. If you really loved what you did, you normally wouldn't get paid for it. So in the world, if you like something, you pay. If you don't like something, the other person pays. So that's BS. But the fact is that there's a continuum of love it, hate it. So, you know, is it something which you're okay with doing? Let's put it like that. Maybe you are not looking forward to going to work every day. And I don't think anybody is. But is it something which you're okay with doing? Do you think that the job, and these are things that you always have to, and one another thing which I didn't write, and I've, now that I think of it, is that you have to evaluate the role that you're in. If the role that you're in makes you progressively less useful to the market, then you may want to reconsider moving before they get to you. So fire before they fire you. Because sometimes it happens that you go get into a role where your skills are not being upgraded. You're not learning anything. Your entire job is doing something which either is in a technology which is increasingly getting obsolete, or it is in some, and this is purely a, you know, technical perspective, but that you are doing something. So let's say you're people managing, and you're people managing, and all day you basically do people management. All day you're basically resolving disputes and stuff. You may want to think how sustainable that is, because your skills are not growing in anything. You know, you can always get somebody in the market who can, you know, who can resolve disputes without knowing much. So that's not really a great value. The value that you provide is technical or some other kind of leadership that you have, which is not just people management. People management is a checkbox. But if you're only doing that, or let's say if you're only doing, from a purely technical point of view, you're doing something which is extremely, extremely niche, like still maintaining COBOL code or something written in Fortran 77, then you may want to consider that, you know, just because you've been doing it for 20 years doesn't mean that it's going to be there tomorrow. So what am I going to do next? It's very important for you. It's very important to lay off proof yourself by always asking, what next? Where am I going next? What am I working towards? Because that whole static, once I get in, I go out at the other end with a watch and a letter from saying, you know, thank you for your years of service at when you're 65 or 60. That way of working is gone. Then you need a sarkari naukri for that. So that's the topic for today in terms of layoffs. The second thing that I wanted to cover again was the future of work. With working from home, so many of us working from home for the last 2 months, I honestly believe that this COVID-19 has caused a lot of damage. We've lost countless lives, and we've lost a lot of, we've blown through all of our net valuations. But it would be terrible if we let this go with only that as its impact and nothing positive. One of the things that I hope will come out of this as a positive would be that that companies will be more sympathetic to working from home. And this is a very, very contentious topic. First of all, before we start, you know, it's obvious that not everything can be done from home. There are lots of jobs like manufacturing, and lots of jobs which cannot be done from home. But a lot of our jobs today are in technology, or with either producing code or verifying code or producing documents. And since the vast majority of people are also individual contributors or manage technical teams, it is not inherently a people-facing function. So there are some jobs which obviously cannot be WFH'd. So whatever I'm going to say is out of scope for this. The other thing is that work from home is, you have to work from home. Forget the employee, forget the employer, but the lifestyle that we have today is unsustainable from an environmental point of view. This is just the amount of traffic, the amount of carbon that we generate is just, and I'm no tree hugger, but it's this is just the science. And what we have seen in the last few months is that our biggest enemies aren't each other. It's not Al-Qaeda or Hindu fundamentalism or whatever you think it is. They can never do the kind of damage that 2 months of an invisible virus has done or that the environment can do. Because we are not attuned as a civilization to guard against these kinds of things. In a way, we are powerless too. And we have military might. And they, I mean, no other nation can kill 70,000 Americans in 2 weeks, in 2 months. It's just not possible and bring down the American economy. It's just not possible. But, you know, it has been done. So the environment, disease, there's really no defense against it. And while disease is, again, something which possibly we will never have a defense against, the environment is, we can do something. And one of the, and it's the, you know, moving towards a kind of Ocasio-Cortez Green Deal may be extreme, but we have to make some sort of move towards cutting down the way we live our lives. And one of the ways that we can do it is having work from home. Now, I'm not saying that even in places where you can work from home, that everybody goes from going to office 5 days a week to going to office 0 days a week. That's, again, not feasible. It's just not going to happen. So there needs to be a phased plan in which we basically cut down going to work, with the ultimate aim end goal being that companies can just let go of prime infrastructure they hold in our cities. That's a savings for the company. And that allows real estate prices to be rationalized in cities. It greatly reduces traffic load at certain points of time. And perhaps, and this is from the employer's point of view, it doesn't mean that the employees can't meet. They can definitely meet up. They can definitely meet up at any place for the social aspect of work, the relationships. But and nobody's saying that that's not important in a work environment. But it just doesn't mean that everybody has to go to work. And going to work in the physical presence of it has just become, I remember that, first of all, one of the things is that it is one of the single biggest reason why women often don't get promoted to places is because women in our, and I, this thing was, is a, again, I didn't, why would I say this? Because I had this conversation with, somebody who I went to school with, and she told me that, you know, she was working in TCS. And she said that, you know, she just couldn't stay for the evenings. And most of the guys, men, just stayed there. They said that one of the big reasons was they actually didn't want to go home because they didn't want to deal with their kids. So they stayed there. And, you know, it's not that they were working. They were going out, having cigarettes, having beer for 2 hours and coming back, doing some work at 7 o'clock, but not much. They could have just finished it in 5 and left. But they intentionally, you know, extend their day so that they can stay at office for like 10 hours, 12 hours, so they'd have to go home. But, you know, she said she had no option because she had children. So she had to go home. And it was always that, you know, by 5 or 6, all the women would leave and all the men would stay. And that itself counted against women and said that they don't stay for the entire time. And rather than looking at people's contribution in terms of their productivity, in terms of deliverables, there's a tendency still to look up to their worth by saying, how long has this person been at work? Which is BS, you know, in software, in technical, and that's absolutely BS. One of the reasons why people don't want to move to working from home is because that would allow, nowadays, much of management, bad management, is essentially dropping by into people's cubicles and basically looking and seeing whether they're working. And if that's the way your manager is keeping their team productive, then obviously the manager isn't doing his job. That a work from home essentially makes management on one hand, easier as well as more challenging, because now you have to have deliverables. You have to do a lot more of the project management part of it in an organized way, rather than, you know, going and peeking into people's cubicles or checking to see if they're have installing software on their machines. I mean, again, this whole thing, this lack of trust that people have, and that's again one of the reasons I was discussing this on Twitter, and people said, "Oh, I wouldn't like my people to work without me looking at them." No, they're not your people, first of all. The relationship that a company should have, again, especially in a place where, in an environment where you can be fired at any point of time, this is not a family thing anymore. This is a very transactional relationship. So the relationship should be defined as, hey, I pay you this amount of money, you provide me this amount of work at this amount of time, and that's it. I don't care where you do that work. As long as your work meets these metrics, which we define beforehand, I don't care where in the world you are. That, first of all, requires very robust engineering and management processes that many places don't have. Right now, Google said that they're basically going to be working from home for the rest of the year. These are, again, progressive organizations where they do have in place things like this. Otherwise, Google wouldn't be doing this. It's because Google wants to move away from queue peaking management, and they want to move to a very strict deliverables based. I think this is a much better way of doing things. It allows people to have a life. It allows people to work on their own schedule, because otherwise flexi work and all of this is, none of this makes any sense, right? If I want to stay awake at night and work and sleep in the morning, I can't do that even with flexi time, because I have to attend meetings. So, you know, all of this is totally and it gives employees another huge thing that they don't have now. And again, this ties in to how easy it is to lay somebody off. One of the biggest problems when you get laid off is your city. Your next job might be in a different city. Your next job might be in another corner of the city, which would add another an hour every day to your commute time. If you work from home, if you can decentralize your office and delocalize it with people working at home, the impact of what a layoff is will be very minimal. You will just dial into another different WebEx. That's it the next day. There's going to be no difference. And given that the old compact, the contract that employers and employees had of this being a family, everybody is in it together, since that has in any case been broken, I don't think that the face-to-face interaction, the dropping in part of it, is that important anymore. Again, I'm not saying that we can practically move from where we are to what I see in a year or 10 years, but this is something that has to be considered seriously. And one of the things that we should do moving forward is just reduce the number of days that you have to come into work. Maybe you come into work on odd even days. I mean, that's maybe how you start. And then, and again, this is, I'm about 2 years ago, I remember I met, I was at a conference and I met this team, because I work in cybersecurity. So I met this team, they were all there, 14 engineers. And it was the first time I saw this. This would be, they were working for one of the most, you know, progressive, medical device cybersecurity. I mean, they're in the insurance sector, actually. So they're pretty much the best when it comes to, you know, healthcare cybersecurity. And so this organization, the 14 guys, and all 14 of them, no two of them worked in the same city. I was at the table with them, and I realized that there no two of them worked in the same city, and that they went to these conferences precisely to meet each other, just to keep that, you know, that relationship intact. So then these guys had been, the only one of them was in the city out of which this company was based, and that was just by chance. And he said, "I don't go to work, by the way, because why would I? None of my team is there." So this is, and in places like cybersecurity where talent is very difficult to find, I mean, this is the only way that you can attract, and people have understood that this is the only way you can retain talent, is by allowing this kind of remote work, because there is no way you can compensate. Like if you decide to get into a salary war with people, then there is always somebody who will beat you on a salary war, on that kind of bidding for people who are very, very good. So what you need to offer to them is something that doesn't cost you any money. It might entail a different style of management, yes, but doesn't cost you money, but allows the person to stay in a place where that person is comfortable staying. It could be in a low-cost area. It could be in a place which doesn't have income tax. It could be in a place where their parents stay. It could be whatever the reasons. But again, which comes back to the way I started, ultimately, it's happiness that we are working for. And money is just a currency for that happiness. And more progressive companies are realizing, hey, we don't need to pay more money to people to make them happy. There are other ways you can make them happy. But just by not having them be stuck in a traffic jam for 2 hours in a day. I mean, that is, forget the environment, a person is happy doing that. I mean, that just gives them back. And again, the counter to that is that never happens. Nobody gets those 2 hours back. You just have to work for those two more hours. Which again, brings us to, you know, how the work is measured. If the work is measured in the number of hours that you're at your terminal, then you're basically, rather than having a physical peeking into your cube, you have a virtual peeking into your cube. It has to be based on deliverables. It has to be based on metrics. Or we do, if you deliver on time and you satisfy the quality metrics, that's it. I don't care whether you did it in an hour, whether you did it in 10 hours, whether you did it overnight. If you're super smart, you could have done it in half an hour. I don't care. This is what I'm paying you. This is what I'm getting. And for many people, and that's why many people in jobs, the boring, the tedium comes from the fact that you have to go there and sit through it. If you are super efficient, you get punished by getting more work. People who are not that efficient don't have to do that work. That is the wrong way of doing things. Everybody should be calibrated based on the amount of work they do. I mean, that's what their salary. Some people might not be able to do that work. Their salary is adjusted to that. And that is the capitalist way of working. What we still have and is a very socialist, you know, time card based, punching in, punching out, a manufacturing. It works in manufacturing where, you know, you have to keep a standing and working. But for things like software, for things like product development, for things like document development, that should not be the case. And again, it comes back to, well, it doesn't matter. They will just keep on increasing work. They'll say, you don't have to come to work. I'll make you work twice as hard. Well, that again is where work from home works, because if your company is going to treat you like that, well, you'll definitely find another company. And that's exactly the way free market works, who will say no. And that's how they will get the best talent. And because it's work from home, it's just monstrously easy to go to that company, because that company doesn't have to be in the exact same location that you are in. I mean, that is what provides you that leverage. The fact that you're no longer physically and geographically constrained to work within companies who are within 5 miles of each other, then you can say, well, there's almost a cartelization. None of these guys will do it because they know. Now they can't do it because they know that their competition isn't the guy which is in the building three blocks down. It's the world. Or at least it's the country. So, in a free market, there'll always be somebody, always be a company which at that point of time, which will break this implicit cartel and said, okay, all right, 40 hours of work, this is what we're going to pay you. And we're not going to ask you for more. You know, this is what we believe is a reasonable amount of work in 40 hours. This is the way we will look at quality. So you don't just keep on writing shit code and calling it, well, I did deliver those files. So, and in software, this quote-unquote metrics, which sounds a lot grander than it is, it's pretty obvious what it is. I mean, if it works, if it passes the tests, it's fine. So I sincerely believe that these 2 months have shown a lot of people, a lot of skeptics, that work from home actually works, and that people don't lose their productivity or their efficiency. As a matter of fact, I believe it goes up. When, you know, your mental health becomes better, when you don't have to be stuck in traffic for 2 hours, when you don't have to just go there, get dressed. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the emotion, I mean, it's not just, it's what can happen on the way to work in terms of accidents, in terms of this. It just takes out a whole lot of stress, you know, a flat tire, everything while going to work, getting late, you know, the emotional stress. It just takes out so many things. And in this day and age, with the technology being as it is, there is really no reason why we cannot rethink the future of work. So that's it for today.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And like I said, I've been in an organization where we've been working from home for the past 5 years. And like you said, forget the human aspect and all. It just makes a lot of business sense because we've been able to retain our team members, women, especially, their maternity leaves. They say, you know what, I don't want to go on extended maternity leave because it's convenient for them to be able to work from home. So retention is better. Overall satisfaction is better. And like you said, we've been able to attract talent from smaller cities. And, so since people can stay at home with their families, it's a win-win. So
absolutely. I mean, we are moving to a world where we're looking for diversity. How can you have diversity when you expect people to come to work? There are people with physical disabilities. You basically, if you basically make their lives much more difficult by having them drive to work. You have people people who, and it is true that, and as I said with my example, is that this expectation of people to be at work, this works obviously against women predominantly. And this is the way, based on the way we work, gender bias is built into our office structures. This is the way really it works. And working from home democratizes things so much. People, as you just now said, people who have some conditions, people who are working with health issues, there's no reason for them to get up and go to work. If they are able to persist, if you're in a wheelchair, the most companies are not built. I mean, in the US they have to be,
yes.
But in India they aren't. They aren't built for accessibility. In that case, let that person be in a space in which that person is comfortable in. That person's, he shouldn't, I mean, this is where how discrimination comes in. I mean, there's no way that there is no discrimination if you expect somebody to come to work and expect that there will not be. Then that person will take 1.5 hours to reach there. That person is working much more effectively than somebody else.
Totally.
This is the way of taking all of these things out and just looking at people as ultimately as cogs in a wheel. That is true. But that is the most fair way of looking at people, is that I pay you this money, you provide me this output. That's it.
Absolutely.
In your own space.
And the point you made about saving, office costs, like I said, we actually did this for 2 years and came out with a formal business case. And in large organizations, of course, you have inter-department billing, right? So, for example, if I have 20 people sitting in the office, I have to pay the housekeeping and I have to pay the
yes.
I have to pay, essentially rent 20 seats from them. So we have been able to release all of that and essentially the team becomes more profitable.
And yes, and again, I mean, this is so win-win for everyone. Rather than giving people raises, people can just move to places which don't require them to stay close to work. They can stay an hour's drive away from the city. They don't have to come into work. I mean, it just reduces their overall stress. It reduces their own cost of living. It allows you to save money by not giving them an increment just for them to come in. And also it reduces the pressure on housing in India's cosmopolitan cities, where many,
yes,
erstwhile residents of the city on a fixed income and on pensions can no longer afford to stay in the place that they used
Absolutely.
To stay because they cannot compete with corporate money.
And one last point though, Arnab, in the last, of course, people have been working from home in IT for quite some time. But in the last 2 months with everyone doing that, one amazing thing that has happened is the normalization of household noises and household interruptions. So previously, let's say a kid comes, your son or daughter comes and asks you some question. We hastily hush them away and pretend as if, we are in a very sterile environment. But now, everyone has a dog barking. Everyone has this and we're all okay. We're like, people accept it. Okay, it's fine.
Exactly. And that is the point they're trying to make. Ultimately, you know, this old feudal, almost feudal mindset of people coming in and you owning their time at that point of time, that you own their undivided attention, that your daughter coming in or something else, your life impinging, is, you should be sorry for that. You should apologize for it, essentially.
Exactly.
That has to change because, hey, you don't own my time. You own a set of deliverables at this level of quality. That's what you own. You do not own me. And that's why you let me go. Tomorrow you can just say, shh, go ahead, because there is absolutely no sense of ownership. It's not a relationship. The companies have kept that part of the old relationship part of it, that when I'm talking with you, don't check your phone kind of thing, because we're in a relationship. But tomorrow I can absolutely let you go in 5 minutes. So if that is true, then this has to be true too. So the layoffs and the working from home, actually, I mean, those topics are related in a way.
Yes.
Both of them relate to the future of work.
Okay. So I guess that's our podcast for today. I actually have nothing else to say, except I did want to ask you something. You had tweeted about, you had tweeted this link to one of Anahita's pictures and asked us to vote.
Yes. So I had tweeted, yeah. Exactly. So again, this is a competition that the ICCRT is conducting. And my mother sent me this link. This is open for citizens from all across the world. So it's not, my daughter is a US citizen. So she's eligible to participate in this thing. I mean, the categories are below 20. So my daughter is 7. Of course, she can't compete with people who are in their 20s in terms of her drawing skills. But we, you know, she drew this and we decided, oh, this looks good. We'll send it there. And so if you could just vote, I don't think that that matters. I don't know why there's a voting link. Like vote. I mean, at least my daughter will be encouraged to see that there are a lot of votes. So, you know, if you like the painting, if you want to encourage my daughter, as most of you follow me know that she's very active. She's always doing something or the other, writing a poem or, you know, painting.
She's been
something
on the podcast thrice so far.
Yes. Yes. And she wants to come back again. She's been telling me many times that, you know, when am I coming back as a guest? So,
here's a quick question though. In the link, I see a heart symbol. Is voting as simple as just hearting it?
Yes, vote is just the heart symbol.
Oh, okay. I was looking for a vote button or something. Okay.
No.
That's... Heart is the vote. Okay, got it.
Okay.
So we'll have a link to it in the show notes too.
Yes, please click the link. Please go and look at it and please vote. It'll heart mean a lot it to my daughter. Yes.
All right. I think that's pretty much it for this week. So,